Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Archaeology is the gift that keeps on giving in downtown St. Louis. We'll explain in a couple of moments. But first, America seems to be going through a period of self-evaluation right now. Much of it centers on issues of economic and racial disparities. Our first guest today focuses on these and other issues using a lens with a very sharp focus. Sarah Kendzior is a St. Louis freelance journalist blogger who also holds a Ph.D. in anthropology from Washington University. She has written for many publications, including The New York Times, The Atlantic, and Politico. Her new book, The View from Flyover Country, is a series of provocative and insightful essays on the kind of world we live in. She wrote them as an op-ed columnist for Al Jazeera English. Among other things, she has paid a lot of attention to the Ferguson story, which she has covered on the ground. Sarah, so nice to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'd like to clarify something because I think a lot of people are confused about Al Jazeera. Uh-huh. A lot of people are suspicious of it because it's Arab-based and they think maybe there's a propaganda element here. Give us your explanation of Al Jazeera.
Oh, that's ridiculous. I mean, at this point, there are two branches of Al Jazeera. There's Al Jazeera English, which is the international branch, you know, just called so because they publish in English language, and Al Jazeera America, you know, which is a homegrown branch, which people in St. Louis don't have access to. I don't think it plays here, so maybe they're not able to ascertain what it's really about. But no, you know, when I was working at Al Jazeera English, I had a great editor who was very open to stories that I was interested in about race, about labor exploitation, about kind of everyday problems, and they really covered a broad array of content.
That's about what I was going to ask, is what they were expecting of you, and I think you've just covered that. Let's talk early on about Ferguson, because you've spent a lot of time there and you've given it a lot of thought. Your overall take on where we are and what's happened?
I think there's been a lot of discussion about Ferguson, as anyone in St. Louis would know. You know, there's been a lot of meetings, there's been a lot of commissions, there's been a lot of protests. But what I don't think we've really seen is a change in policy. I interviewed activists from Ferguson for an article I wrote for the New York Daily News, and one of them described, you know, the situation on the ground as chairs being shuffled on the Titanic. And I essentially think that's true. You know, there's been resignations and changes in personnel, but the key problems of Ferguson have not been addressed. I don't think that, you know, issues with the police force and police brutality against the black community of St. Louis has been addressed. And I also don't think the sort of day-to-day poverty that people are living in North County, not just Ferguson, has been addressed sufficiently either.
We have an email here. I'll just get your reaction to it. The writer says, "So very, very, very tired of Ferguson. Can we please move on?" What does that tell you?
I think people are tired of Ferguson. And, you know, I think part of that is because Ferguson has become a symbol more than a place, you know, for a lot of Americans. People seeing it on the outside are seeing coverage that is often very repetitive. You know, I think when the national media comes in, they interview the same people. They kind of, you know, create filler in their story. You really saw this in November when they were waiting for, you know, the grand jury decision. And we had the state of emergency that drew them in earlier, and they had nothing to do but kill time. And I think it kind of increased the tension, increased this feeling of waiting. I think people are exhausted and burnt out on the subject, and that is understandable. But at the same time, you know, there's a reason that Ferguson has struck such a chord, not just in St. Louis, but nationwide. And it's because it encapsulates all these issues of, you know, of race and unfairness and injustice, you know, that need to be addressed. So, you know, I don't think Ferguson is a topic that we should drop, no matter how sick of it we may be.
Well, of course, Ferguson was just one of many incidents like Ferguson.
Yes.
That happened, and one seemed to kind of propel the other, and it kept the conversation going all over the country.
Yeah, I think Ferguson, you know, it was preceded by the Eric Garner incident and, you know, followed by many more. And
Trayvon Martin prior to that.
Right. Yeah. And so it's part of this continuum. You know, I think that there's a spirit of activism in St. Louis that people were surprised by. I mean, I wasn't particularly surprised by it. You know, before this, we had, you know, the fast food protests. Show Me 15 was the third organization that, you know, was fighting for an increased minimum wage in a union among low-wage workers in America. And so there's this spirit to St. Louis that I think goes kind of undetected by people who don't live here. And so when people came out after Ferguson, you know, I wasn't surprised. I don't think it's surprising that when, you know, a teenage boy is shot and left dead in the road for 4.5 hours, that people will come out and mourn, and that they'll protest the conditions that led to that kind of treatment.
You have a line here that I'll read now that pertains to what you've been talking about. The most recent arrest of people who do not live here written about by people who do not live here for an audience that does not live here.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what Ferguson coverage has become. You know, we've had a lot of parachute journalism of people kind of flying in every 3 to 4 months when something happens, whether it's the original incident or the anniversary or the, you know, the DOJ report. And I think overall that's kind of damaging for getting good reporting out of the region. I think you really need to tackle it every day. And I think that St. Louis media, you know, no matter what their biases may be in certain outlets, has at least been consistent in covering this issues and treating Ferguson as a place full of real people instead of just a symbol.
By the same token, I suppose we in the media here in St. Louis could be criticized also for not having gotten to this story before Michael Brown, because there was a story there, but nobody was covering it.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I think there's always room for self-criticism, and I think a lot of outlets are aware of that. I think that, you know, they've learned within the last year. I think there's also pressures, you know, like if you look at the Post-Dispatch, they have an older white audience that might not necessarily want to hear the kind of sharp critiques of racial politics that are coming out of Ferguson. And so I think they're sort of balancing what the interests and the biases of the readership is with the ability to tell a story.
You call the whole thing a showcase of shame.
Lately, it has been. I mean, I was really disappointed by what happened last week with the mass arrest of protesters. You know, the way, you know, in this case, the police had plenty of time to prepare and how they were going to respond to this. There's an entire website, Ferguson Action, that announced what these, you know, protest actions were going to be. And so none of this was necessary. And then you see the return of other questionable elements like the Oath Keepers. And it just felt like we were in a rerun of a nightmare. And it was disappointing to see how a year had passed and so little had changed.
You know, and looking at your writing in your book, Flyover Country, by the way, people are getting tired of the flyover country thing around here. Have you sensed that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm tired of it, too. You know, the title is a little bit tongue-in-cheek because, you know, this is a real place where important stories happen, and I think it's often dismissed by coastal media. And when I wrote that, it was originally an article, you know, and then I just used that article as the title of the book. And it was to kind of show, you know, things are happening here. And I think in many ways what's considered flyover country is more representative of America. It's just difficult to convince coastal editors of that. Like when I, you know, I had a story in The Guardian recently about payday loan outlets, and people either were like, yes, oh my God, thank you, somebody's finally telling the story, or they were like, what are those? I've never heard of those things. And so we do sort of have two Americas, and the other one, you know, the one that of the coast is one that's not necessarily in touch with the kind of tribulations that people are experiencing in daily life in the rest of America.
You know, I had the feeling what I started to say before the flyover remark was that I had the feeling in reading some of your essays that you were channeling Howard Beale from the movie Network, that you're mad as hell and not going to take it anymore.
I think Charles Jayco is actually doing that right now on Twitter. But, you know, yeah, like I'm frustrated. I think it's normal to be frustrated when you're, you know, continually seeing injustice. I think that that's a normal and healthy reaction to things. You know, often anger is viewed as this negative feeling, but I think, you know, anger is a sign of compassion. If you're angry on somebody else's behalf, it's because you care about what's happening. And I was happy to have that platform at Al Jazeera, and I wanted to use it to highlight these kinds of problems.
I was looking for one of your quotes here. I've got so many. I can't find that with regard to anger, but it will come up in just a moment. What do you tell your kids about all of this? You've got an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old. Are they old enough to have any sense of what's going on?
Oh, the 4-year-old's oblivious. I mean,
sure.
The 4-year-old's
sure.
Concerned with Lego and Star Wars, but you know, my 8-year-old daughter does understand to some degree what's going on. She goes to Jackson Park, which is a majority black elementary school, and they're much more upfront about racial issues. You know, when they study, you know, Martin Luther King, I think they do it in a more serious way. Like they have a celebration called Not a Day But Away, and, you know, try to kind of carry these themes of injustice in a way that young kids can understand. And so she's had a different experience, you know, growing up here in St. Louis than other kids.
You also take exception to the phrase that has been used several times since the Michael Brown incident about things returning to normal.
Yeah, I mean, what's normal here is, you know, for many, is poverty, is repression, is a chronic lack of opportunity. And that's not a normal that we should seek to return to. I think people, you know, naturally were tired of the stress and the panic, especially if you look at what was going on a year ago, where night after night you saw showdowns with the police and it just seemed like nothing was going to change. And this was never going to end. And you were up all night watching that live stream and feeling, you know, an element of despair. But I think these long-term structural problems are what really needs to be addressed. addressed, especially economic disparity and economic inequality.
We have a tweet here regarding St. Louis coverage of racism pre-Ferguson. Says, my comment, I'm sure that's the reference, is not true. St. Louis American covered the disparities fueled by systematic racism before the killing of Michael Brown. And that certainly is the case, but without the widest kind of distribution that some of the other media outlets have.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they definitely did, and it's unfortunate that their work didn't reach a wider audience, and, you know, I'm glad it's doing so now.
Well, but getting back to what I was saying, if more white people read The American, then perhaps the coverage would have been greater.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like any of this isn't being discussed. I mean, the same is true of Twitter. You know, you see people on Twitter, black citizens in St. Louis, talking about what happens in their lives, about being pulled over, about being harassed by cops, about all these things. And then it took the Department of Justice report for all these complaints, which people have been making for years, either on the street or online, seriously. And it's unfortunate that it takes an outside white national voice to make these complaints, you know, have resonance with a broader audience.
Let's take a call. Before we have to take our break, we'll bring in Jerry calling from O'Fallon. Jerry, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Well, good afternoon. I'm just listening here, and I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head several times. I mean, unfortunately, the situation that has caused the, Ferguson and has been in place for decades. And frankly, I think this show, St. Louis on the Air, has done a lot to talk about some of the things such as real estate covenants, et cetera. And it seems that we have a tolerance for, I read a book a few years ago where they use the phrase internal colonies, where we have pockets of poverty where we want to ignore them until something like this happens. But essentially, if everything stays in that area, we just kind of have a tendency to disregard it. And that's really a huge problem that no one seems to want to address.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think he's absolutely right. I mean, especially if you look at North County and at North City. The article that I'm working on now that I just sent to my editor and pray it gets published is on College Hill, you know, which is known as one of the most dangerous parts of the city. And so I went there and walk around and talk to people. And what they kept stressing is that, you know, they didn't want to be viewed as land of crime statistics. They wanted, you know, they have hopes, they have dreams, they have aspirations that are unfulfilled. You know, I talked to one guy who's running a program for children that he says can't get funding. And so you see people in these neighborhoods doing things to try to improve their own community with very little support and very little outreach from the broader St. Louis community, you know, especially the majority white St. Louis community.
I want to pick up on that point, but we do have to take a break. We're talking with Sarah Kendzior. She's a journalist and the author of The View from Flyover Country, a series of essays that she'd written when working for Al Jazeera English. Come back and continue our conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. Or if you'd prefer to send a tweet, do it to STL on Air. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. You know, getting back to our conversation now with Sarah Kendzior, author of The View from Flyover Country, it occurs to me, and a lot of people, I'm sure, and I'm quite certain with you, that the poor in this country are largely invisible. And I go to one quote that you had, "The poor, the unemployed, the lacking are vilified for the things they lack."
Yeah, I think poverty is presented as a character flaw, you know, that's always the impetus is to, you know, blame the person for their plight rather than to look at the social conditions that have produced it. You know, I think in St. Louis especially, you could see, evidence of generations of poverty, of intergenerational poverty. And since so much in America relies on inherited wealth, there are people that are born without opportunity and have, you know, no way to embrace opportunity in the future because they lack the capital to fund it.
Yeah. Another quote that you have, and I've got a page full of quotes here because I'm very interested in some of the things you say and the way you think. You say, Americans should not fear riots. They should fear apathy.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think there's also something to fear in riots when you're talking about physical violence. I think I wrote that when everyone was predicting riots after the Trayvon Martin shooting. And, you know, those riots did not come to pass. And, you know, I was responding to this inclination of the media to assume that black people are violent and that when, you know, a tragedy happens, they're going to react in a violent way. And you still see this tendency. I mean, when the NWA movie came out, you know, people couldn't believe that people didn't get shot up in the theaters. And so that's just a real media bias. But I think the kind of apathy toward, you know, toward decay, towards abandonment, towards communities that have been abandoned towards generations, you know, for generations is really what we need to fear and concentrate on.
Before we move on to some other things that you write about, let's take a couple of calls related to the conversation so far. Mike in North St. Louis joins us. Mike, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes. This comment, this lady said, intergenerational poverty. Let me tell you, miss, black folks, I'm 65 years old. We black people, African-Americans in North St. Louis, have built homes, had businesses up and down the streets. We've had cleaners, filling stations, black-on-black crime, and all this stuff about and this criminality within our community, just like this thug movie out of Compton, pure garbage. What is that going to teach kids about going to school? And it's and we living in cages. Is the police making us live in cages? It's more bars on our windows than in the St. Louis Zoo. Is it the white folks? Is it the police? And how are you going to make a movement built on a lie? This boy hit the police upside the head, tried to hurt him and kill him. So what was he? This was nothing like Trayvon Martin or Rodney King, and all this stuff about black folks beat down in it. We done this to ourselves.
Mike, thank you for the call.
Well, thank you for your comment. I don't agree that the movement is, you know, is based on this. I think crime is a serious issue, you know, especially in St. Louis. I also think the roots of crime are often poverty and desperation, and that if you attack these, you know, broader social problems, you might get a, you know, a decrease in crime.
Mike, again, thanks for the call. Let's bring in Paul calling from Edwardsville.
Good afternoon. Your author has made a lot of broad statements about a lack of resources for the Afro-American community. By the way, I'm a three-time Obama voter. It seems to me that the government has spent millions, if not billions, of dollars on anti-poverty programs with very little success. And the question I have is, do you believe that a priori, if there is income inequality between any identifiable groups, that that means that racism is involved?
I think that there's all sorts of inequalities. There's economic inequality and there's racial inequality. And, you know, they often intersect. I mean, this is a country that was built on slave labor. This is a country that, you know, where Jim Crow is just a generation away. And I think that we still feel the effects of this today. One thing that's a particular barrier today is the cost of education. In order to get ahead, you need to have these expensive credentials, which most people can't afford. And I think that when you don't have that level of inherited wealth, which, you know, so many black families don't have, you're unable to pay for college. And you're unable to have access to the kind of white collar opportunities that other people can get.
Yeah, that brings
all
us
right,
to.
Well, no offense, but I mean, you remind me of my brother, Berkeley graduate in African studies. I think that the folks like you are just giving cover for all the terrible problems in the Afro American community. I agree about mass incarceration and unfairness in sentencing. That should be done away with. It's terrible. I believe that any young person is willing to work hard ought to be able to get an education in this country. But if you're going to posit that the problems, as the gentleman prior to me pointed out, aren't going to have to be addressed within that community itself for progress to be made, I think you're doing a disservice to that community.
But I think that community is addressing these problems. I'm constantly talking to black people in St. Louis who are trying to address these problems of crime, you know, as well as problems like police brutality. It's not an either-or situation. And I think you have plenty of people committed to both.
All right. Let's take one more call on this, and then we'll move on to some other subjects that Sarah has written about. Jacqueline in Tower Grove. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for accepting my call, longtime listener, first time calling, so thank you. My question today is, how do you recommend that, like, young progressive people who really care about this movement bring these subjects up to families or in-laws when they are making, like, racist comments at the dinner table? Like, what's a good way to go about discussing these issues with them that's not offensive, but it's also understanding to their viewpoint?
I mean, I think, you know, politeness goes a long way, but so does, you know, honesty in what you're telling them. I think there are a lot of resources written firsthand by Black people about their own experiences, and that's often the most powerful way to get this across. I think when you look at it as a statistical issue or as sort of a broad social issue, you miss that human element. But when you hear people talking firsthand about what they've been through, you know, that's often a more compelling way to get people to change their minds.
Okay, I'll take one more call on this, and then we'll move on. Ellen in Kirkwood, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm calling to ask what everybody thinks about this idea that when people are wrongly accused of something, which is so often part of prejudice, the person who has been wrongly accused gets so frustrated time after again, that it leads to anger and lashing out. And I think, you know, moving to resolve this is keeping an open mind and being very careful about really looking at different points of view and really trying to figure out, you know, what the problem is, who, maybe that person did not do it. Maybe it's more complicated. And so the issue is being wrongly accused and how to stop. Thank you.
I'm not completely sure I understand the question. I mean, it's a terrible thing to be wrongly accused of anything, but I think, you know, if you're wrongly accused of something, to just look towards the evidence that can prove your position and just go forward from there.
Right.
Right. And I'm asking other people to avoid jumping to conclusions.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Let's move on to one or two other things while we have the time, Sarah. You brought in higher education a couple of moments ago, and I know you have some very specific ideas on it. You call academia a caste system. What do you mean by that? And there's another line here. You're concerned, speaking of academia, about the low-earning academics, how many they are, and the influence that has on our higher education.
Yeah, I mean, the majority of academics are low-earning academics, or adjunct instructors earning something about, you know, $2,500 per course, teaching maybe, you know, one or two courses per semester, often living under the poverty line, you know, some are homeless. And they're doing the exact same work as a tenured professor who is making a living wage. You know, they're teaching courses, they're doing research. And so there's no real reason for this other than people are lured in by, you know, the promise of future employment as a full-time professor, and also by the prestige of the profession. You know, I think this is one of many professions in which prestige has been used, you know, in order to justify a low salary. You see this in journalism, you see this in policy, you see this in any field where there's unpaid internships or very low paid labor or unpaid labor. And, you know, the problem is that it leads to a subpar education for students who are paying an exorbitant amount of money to get it.
And what about the college debt? We just heard yesterday that college debt for the students now amounts to $1.3 trillion. Much publicized that that's more than credit card debt, but now they've added auto loan debt to that. It just, and it's going to double within the next couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, we're really in a generational crisis. You know, the way that people my age, you know, and I'm in my mid-30s, the way we live is very different than the way our parents live. And I think this is really coming to a head because, you know, my generation, which carries so much of this college debt, we're now parents and, you know, we have children and those children will be going to college. And if, the tuition keeps increasing at the rate that it's going, there's going to be no way that we can pay for it. And so I think, you know, 5, 10, 15 years down the road, you're going to see the system implode. Either that or the kind of credentialism that has become, you know, a regular occurrence in applying for a job will have to disappear. There are so many jobs now that require expensive credentials that didn't used to, you know, jobs that you don't necessarily need to go to college to do. And I think maybe by lowering the barrier to entry and looking more at skill and talent rather than expensive credentials, you know, we could help solve this problem.
You also say that in the world of academia, wealth is passed off as merit.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, in order to continue in academia, you know, to work as an academic after graduation, you know, you need to either have a lot of money that you can pull from, or you need to be willing to live in poverty or to carry on debt of your own. You know, I could never afford to adjunct. A lot of people think that I was an adjunct because I wrote so much about it. But honestly, that's just a job I couldn't afford to do. And that's the America that we're living in, is where, you know, a job is something you can't afford. A job is not what pays you. It's what you're paying to do.
And yet, you know, we've talked to a number of of leaders in area institutions of higher learning. And they all have the same complaint, and that is that they're running out of money. I mean, they're charging exorbitant rates, if you will. The institutions are tuition rates, and yet they're in financial crisis. 700 colleges may be shutting down in the next year or two.
Right, and I think a lot of that has to do with the allocation of money. I mean, there's been broad cuts in public universities, which is its own problem. But when you look at how universities are spending the money that they do have, a lot of it is going towards administration and hiring, you know, a surplus of deans. A lot of it goes towards athletics, or it goes towards fancy infrastructure. And, you know, you could just go to WashU to see an example of that. And so I think the priority isn't necessarily education. You know, the priority is selling a package to prospective parents who maybe donors in the future.
Yeah. We there are so many areas we can cover. I'll refer people to the book. I mean, you talk about meritocracy, you talk about the media, you talk about any number of things. We can't discuss them all, but we have a lot of calls on the subject that got us started. So let's get as many of those in as we can.
Okay.
We'll go back to Moshe, I believe it is, calling from North St. Louis. Go ahead.
Yes. How you doing today?
Hi. Good. Go ahead. Go ahead, Moshe.
Yes. I want to know what were the resources, because a lot of times we hear that there's resources in a community. And I wanted to know, what's the resource for middle-aged youth, someone 18 or 19 years old that's involved in gang activity or drug activity or some type of crime in the community? What type of resource do they have in the community besides a recreational center or a place to get on a computer?
I think that's a good question, and I think that, you know, that's a question everyone in St. Louis should be asking, because I don't think there are enough of the resources available that aren't, you know, recreational. I don't think that there are enough programs that provide education. I know that there are some that are starting. I know, you know, Hands Up United and Ferguson is doing things like teaching kids to code. I know that there are other organizations that are trying to get off the ground and provide opportunity. The question is often a matter of money and, you know, shifting the money to make opportunity for youth in that position a priority.
Thank you for the call. Let's bring in Mark calling from Del Mar. Go ahead, Mark.
Hi.
Hi.
I am a longtime listener. I really like your program. So I recently moved to Del Mar from over in Illinois, and I can't help but notice all the gated communities over in Del Mar that have really extravagant houses. And I feel like a lot of the problem with people not caring so much about current events and issues like Ferguson is that they'll try to shove out lower socioeconomic people from even around their houses. And, you know, we put up these gated communities and try to shove everyone out who's not like ourselves. And I feel like that's a real crime in St. Louis. I just wanted to comment on that.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, that goes back, you know, decades, if not centuries. You know, the Del Mar Divide is a common subject. The artist Damon Davis did a good project on that, in which he had different people from each side of the divide writing letters to kind of express, you know, what life is like where they live. And so I think that kind of outreach just to promote general awareness is helpful. But, you know, the bottom line is that you have people on one side living in real economic despair and people on the other side, you know, living on a level of comfort that allows them the ability to look away. And, you know, I think if we refuse to look away, if we look closer at our neighborhoods and, you know, don't treat them as if they're a foreign country, which is something that I think we do too often in St. Louis, that, you know, we have progress possible.
We'll take one more call, but this has got to be fast. Dina in St. Louis, please make it quick.
Hi, I was just calling to basically make a comment. I stay in the St. Louis area, and I was just telling the guy that I think majority of the problem is that most people that are counseled are kind of counseled by other white people that really haven't experienced the lifestyle, because it's really not a black or white thing. It's a lifestyle.
Go ahead. We'll have to interrupt her to get a response to that.
Yeah, I'm curious what the rest of that comment would say. But I definitely think that, you know, there's too much of white people talking about the black experience and not enough of, you know, black people having a voice in it. You definitely see this in media, you know, where the number of black reporters is very low. And so I think, you know, just having people be able to have an access to tell their experience directly to a white audience, you know, would be beneficial.
We only have about 45 seconds. You also say that you have to be wealthy to enter the field of journalism today. What do you mean by that? Can you say it in 20 seconds?
Unpaid internships, unpaid labor, expensive graduate school credentials up to $60,000 a year are part of, you know, what requires, you know, what requirements are there to become a journalist. And I think that's unfortunate and locks a lot of people out.
Free labor, in other words.
Yeah.
You have to be able to afford to work for nothing.
Yes.
All right. Sarah Kendzior, thank you so much for being with us. I really recommend your book. You've got a lot of insight, a lot of interesting comments and observations. The book, again, is titled The View from Flyover Country. It's available. I know I read it on Kindle the other day, which was a new experience for me, and I loved it. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Best of luck with the book. We're going to have to move along now. When we come back, another look at what we're learning about our French colonial past from downtown archaeological findings. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.